Hello, on this week's program, David Patrick Stearns profiles Isabel Faust. The German violinist performs the Brahms Violin Concerto in concerts with the Philadelphia Orchestra this weekend. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Nemours Mansion and Gardens in Wilmington, Delaware. The 300-acre estate was home to the industrialist and philanthropist Alfred I. DuPont and recently completed a $39 million restoration. As the National Constitution Center opens its new show on Napoleon, Susan Lewis explores the French connection between America and the Emperor of early 19th century France. And we speak with Jennifer Childs and Tony Braithwaite. They created and star in Let's Pretend We're Married, the latest from 1812 Productions. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The last-minute stand-in is the most time-honored and honorable method of career advancement in classical music. But instead of replacing the indisposed 20-something violinist Yulia Fischer with some brighter young thing wanting to start at the top, the Philadelphia Orchestra brought in the 30-something violinist Isabel Faust for this weekend's string of Brahms violin concerto performances, just as the Boston Symphony did a few weeks ago when Fischer cancelled there. Though unknown to American concertgoers, Faust is a major presence in Europe, with numerous recordings on the Harmonia Mundi label. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns spent some anxious moments with her backstage at the Kimmel Center on Wednesday as she prepared to go for her first rehearsal with the orchestra.
Classical music internet chat rooms can be combative for the sake of it. Though after Julia Fischer's announced cancellation in Philadelphia, the tone greeting her replacement, Isabel Faust, was downright comforting. Comments described Faust as intense, powerful, and full of blood and guts. In person, the worldly stylish Faust comes off like the quintessential Berliner with her short-cropped hair and slim silhouette. On recordings, she's tough and seemingly unsentimental. Wrong, says Faust.
I do feel more moved by things if they are as naked, as innocent as possible. And if I put a lot of varnish on it, it doesn't move me anymore. So that's my way of being the most intimate and the most true. Also, I can kind of not really be very trustful in my emotions if I don't have a clear logical line in an interpretation.
Whatever qualities were at work, Faust's Philadelphia Orchestra performance was applauded long and loud enough on Thursday to prompt an encore, some unaccompanied Bach. Afterwards, the exiting audience seemed quiet and thoughtful more than thrilled. You have to listen harder to her smallish sound in Verizon Hall. Also, her playing represents a uniquely 21st century confluence of influences. Growing up in a certain amount of isolation in a small town outside of Stuttgart, she played in a string quartet from an early age and studied a piece that most violinists take their time getting to if they play it at all, Bartók's 1944 Sonata for Unaccompanied Violin. Her early recording of the piece brought her more attention than the typical career-making competitions she entered as a teenager. The most significant factor in her life was Christoph Papen, her primary teacher and later a collaborator. They recorded Bach violin concertos together, he's deep into the early music scene, and he conducted when Faust delved into the dark Germanic waters of Concerto Funebre by the 20th century composer Carl Amadeus Hartmann. She jokes that orchestra managers don't exactly jump for joy when she asks to play any number of modern works that she champions. In playing more conventional repertoire, Faust is clearly aware of the lower vibrato, less imposing principles of historically informed performance. That's partly what makes her playing naked, and one theory, why her Beethoven violin concerto recording received better reviews than that of the more mature and revered Vadim Repin, released at the same time. Mentioning that seems to embarrass her.
Yeah, well, that doesn't mean anything. That doesn't mean anything. Don't believe. Sorry to tell you, but...
Brahms' violin concerto, Faust talks about the importance of knowing what the composer at that point in history would have known. She does exhaustive historic research, often going back to the original manuscripts, so much that she's all but made a new edition of the Schumann violin concerto. But none of this is an end in itself. It's her starting point.
Brahms comes very much out of Beethoven, and Beethoven comes out of Mozart. And we always have to not forget that those composers didn't know what came afterwards. They had maybe a slight idea what it would kind of develop to. They knew what was before, so we have to rather study what they knew as music and what they were influenced by.
My appreciation for Isabel Faust developed slowly. That unvarnished quality she speaks about seemed to lack grace. Yet, the more I listened, the more Faust's playing seemed to be getting at the music with an efficiency that more stylish violinists lack. Then I began to hear the way she shapes phrases, unlike anyone else, and how much sense that makes. What's not apparent in her recordings is how much she's willing to treat the text of a classic as something that's living and dynamic. She's had two different composers write new cadenzas for the Beethoven Violin Concerto, and in her forthcoming recording of the Beethoven Violin Sonatas, she returned to her already finished recording of the Kreutzer Sonata to insert some surviving embellishments she discovered recently, ones that Beethoven's violinist used in the world premiere, much to the composer's delight. If and where we'll find them in Faust's recording is a question she can't and won't answer.
Actually, I'm not quite sure if it really worked, because we had to record it then much later, and they said we will try if we can make it match, you know, the recording. And actually, I'm not quite sure. I have to ask now if they really managed to fit it in or not. So we'll see. Everybody has to listen now to the first movement of the Kreutzer to see if they find the embellishment or not. It's like a quiz now. You have to find out yourself.
And how many violinists would have the brains to keep their public guessing and the guts to carry it out?
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Isabel Faust performs the Brahms Violin Concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall this evening at 8 and tomorrow afternoon at 2.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The grounds of the Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware, are also home to the mansion of the man who made the medical center possible. The hospital opened its doors in 1940 in accordance with DuPont's will. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the Nemours Mansion and Garden date from 1910 and today help tell the compelling story of the 20th century philanthropist.
From the outside, the estate looks like a fortress, protected by tall, thick walls topped by broken glass. It's perhaps emblematic of the private and privileged life led by Alfred DuPont. Yet behind the walls is a sprawling property that's now open to the public. And this is what Alfred DuPont wanted. As he neared his death in 1935, he instructed his trustees to ensure that the mansion and surrounding gardens were well cared for the pleasure of everyone. A narrow tree-lined stretch of green, nearly a quarter mile long, leads to the front of the DuPont mansion. At the far end of this vista, opposite the mansion, is the Temple of Love, a dome that houses a life-sized statue of Diana the Huntress. Nemours's Stephen Maurer says the view from the temple demonstrates a key design of the estate.
If you stand here, you can look dead straight ahead, and you go right up through the vista, and you're dead center on the house. So you can see it's a point one end to the other. And that's how Mr. DuPont wanted you to see these grounds. Not so much from the sides, because he wanted you to get a sense of the grandness of everything.
The majestic property, inspired by the great palace of Versailles, was funded by the fortune Alfred DuPont amassed as part of the family's gunpowder business. Nemours' executive director, Grace Gary, says DuPont was a proud descendant of an aristocratic family that fled France during the French Revolution. Ending up in Delaware, they started their black powder business in the Brandywine Valley in the early 1800s.
He always wanted to focus people's attention on the accomplishments of his family, which he did not think of as in monetary terms. The company was very successful even before Alfred was born, but what he thought of as the accomplishments of his family was the fact that his great-great-great-grandfather had served the court of Louis XVI, had been a leading figure in the French Revolution, and then had had the courage to come with his entire family to Delaware and start life anew.
Born in 1864, Alfred DuPont embraced life in the powder mill early on, and with a knack for all things mechanical, he quickly rose up through the ranks of the profitable company. Yet his personal life was turbulent. At the age of 13, DuPont lost both of his parents. His first marriage ended in divorce, a social taboo in the early 20th century. And, says Grace Gary, the Nemours mansion and its formal gardens were built for DuPont's second wife, Alicia, a divorcee herself.
And his wife, his new wife, was not invited to some of the social events in Delaware that she and Alfred would have liked to attend. And I believe that had something to do with why he built Nemours. I don't know that. He didn't write and tell us. But I think that he was thinking to himself, well, if no one's going to invite my wife to their house, I'm going to give her the best house in town.
Nemours was named after the DuPont family's hometown in France and predominantly built in a French neoclassical style. Along with a chauffeur's garage that houses vintage cars, the 47,000-square-foot mansion, with ornate architectural details, is much the same as it was when the DuPonts lived here, filled with plush furniture and fine artwork. Portraits from early American painters like Gilbert Stuart and James Peel line the walls. Nemours' registrar, Francesca Bonny, points to a clock that was made for the French queen, Marie Antoinette.
The clock contains a dulcimer and a pipe organ, and it can be programmed to play on the hour, or you can just make it play at will. It's kind of like a music box. Actually, we have 16 different airs we can play on the clock. Would you like me to play the clock
for
you?
Oh, please, yeah.
Alfred DuPont had a passion for music. He played violin and piano and even composed music until he lost his hearing in the 1920s. His instruments can be seen in his music room, where he spent many hours practicing, composing, and performing. Within the other 70-plus rooms of the mansion are tapestries that are hundreds of years old and dozens of chandeliers. There's a bowling alley, a billiards room, and a conservatory, home to cages of parakeets, canaries, and doves, the kind of birds that the DuPonts kept. DuPont's love of nature is also evident in the grounds. Like the house, the formal French-style gardens of Nemours were also modeled after those at Versailles. Meticulously tended by a team of 12 gardeners, mazes of shrubbery, pink-flowering chestnuts, and pin oaks fill the over 200 acres. At the center of the garden is a gleaming gold-leaf classical statue beside a large reflecting pool, complete with a 157-jet fountain. The awe-inspiring gardens that celebrate Alfred DuPont's French heritage evoke a sense of European aristocracy. Yet Grace Gary says the history and dazzle of the idyllic estate should not overshadow Alfred DuPont's determination to share his good fortune. Towards the end of his life, he became deeply involved in philanthropy. Starting in 1929, he funded pensions for every person in need in Delaware over the age of 65. While this only lasted a few years, until Social Security was enacted under President Franklin Roosevelt, DuPont had planned to continue it much longer.
When he started that, he had no idea that it would ever come to an end because he had no way to foresee that Social Security would eventually be created in the United States. And I think that's when Alfred really began to think in the terms that we today think of as philanthropy. And in fact, he left the bulk of his estate to create what is today one of the largest pediatric healthcare networks in the United States.
Alfred DuPont is buried under a bell tower on the Children's Hospital grounds, neighboring the Nemours Mansion and Gardens. Both the medical and mansion grounds are integral parts of DuPont's enduring legacy, a monument to a man of great wealth and generosity.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Nemours Mansion and Gardens in Wilmington, Delaware is open May through December. On the heels of the 18th century American War for Independence came another revolution, An Ocean Away. A new traveling exhibition at Philadelphia's National Constitution Center explores the life of the ruler who emerged to make his mark on not only France but much of Europe. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the French connection between America and the Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte.
Americans, even those who aren't students of European history, are apt to recognize the image of Napoleon, the military commander standing upright in full dress coat, wearing a triangular-looking black hat with the side brim facing front, one arm bent at the elbow, one hand disappearing mysteriously between the buttons of his tunic.
A lot of people say that because he eats too fast. No way. It's because at the time, for the guy, it was no pocket on the pen, and the only place to put your arm, your hand, it was inside your jacket.
Pierre-Jean Chalasson has been studying, admiring, and collecting Napoleonic artifacts since he was a child.
My father gave me a book about him, and I said to my father, wow, look, this guy is great, it's like Superman. My father said, no, it's not Superman, he was real, you know, he was in real life.
In real life, Napoleone de Buonaparte was born in Corsica and grew up to be Napoleon Bonaparte, the French military commander. Stepping into the leadership breach left by the French Revolution, he eventually crowned himself Napoleon I, Emperor of France.
And I think Napoleon was a self-made man, because Napoleon was a simple guy from nowhere, not really French. He speak Italian, and a bad Italian, a bad French. You know, it was a go-between. It's why Napoleon, for me, it's a big hero, you know.
Despite the recent destruction of the previous royal household, Napoleon created an imperial court with family members, colleagues, and friends. He embraced Enlightenment ideas about the rights of man, promoted the arts, and created civil codes for rational governance. But he also waged wars in the name of spreading those ideas across Europe, alienating himself from some who might otherwise admire him, both today and then. As one example, legend has it that in 1804, musical master Beethoven ripped the title page from his Bonaparte symphony and renamed it Eroica. Today, Daniel Thomas Easton, formerly Philadelphia's French consul, now director of a consulting firm, France Philadelphie, has mixed feelings.
He was, of course, instrumental in so many things, whether it is the emancipation of the Jews, the development of the metric system, the Napoleonic Code. But in terms of the slaughters, the many corpses left all over the battlefields of Europe, there may be some aspects that are a little bit somber.
And yet, says Easton, he also gave the French a sense of their nation.
It's something about your visceral sense of belonging. And with Napoleon, the myth, the grandeur of Napoleon, the martyrdom, the exile, all that has created an image of Napoleon that we don't really want to discard.
The show now at the National Constitution Center tells the story of Napoleon the man through items from the collection of Pierre-Jean Chalasson. Nearly 25 years after getting his first poster at the age of 14, Chalasson now has hundreds of books, maps, letters, furniture, clothing, fine china, and artwork, objects in which he takes more than a scholarly interest.
That's a big difference between a museum and a private collector. In the museum, the artifacts are not any longer alive, you know, because they are in a showcase and nobody uses it. Me, I have books, I use it. I have silver, I use it. I have armchair, I use it. You know, it's important to use the things, because after, if you don't use, it's dead.
For this show, 300 of the objects are presented museum-style. Visitors don't get to nap on the luxurious bed of Napoleon's brother, stretch out on the military camp cot, or sit at the elegantly set dining table. But on the walls hang large and small paintings, iconic portraits and large scenes of pomp and circumstance. Roman-style busts, silver, clothing, books, and personal items are protected in glass cases. The display presents a chronological narrative, from the Egyptian campaign to his assumption of power to his coronation and reign. Rooms are devoted to his family and the court he assembled, to his interest in the arts, and to his military endeavors, as well as his defeats and periods of exile. One of his famous hats sits in a glass case at the end. Text panels in each room explore the American connections. President of the National Constitution Center, Linda Johnson, points to the pivotal role played by the American Revolution.
We believe that revolution was in the air and that what we did here had an impact in France.
French financial support of the American Revolution had depleted the treasury of France. Discontent with the monarchy, joined with ideas about liberty and self-rule, gleaned from both Enlightenment scholars and from across the ocean.
The reformers in France looked to the American Revolution and the early American Republic as being the acting out of reform instincts.
Constitutional law professor A.E. Dick Howard of the University of Virginia says American state constitutions were translated into French.
Then the French could use the American constitutions as a point of departure for debating the kinds of arrangements they ought to have in France.
In the end, the French rejected the American constitutional model with its separation of powers and checks and balances, and instead invested all political power in its legislative body, the National Assembly. As a result, says Howard, as the French Revolution took an increasingly dark turn,
opposition to the National Assembly was opposition to the people, and that in turn was treason. What you finally had was the Reign of Terror, the guillotine, all the rest. And that move to the radical side, in effect, laid the foundation for the execution of the king, a period of turbulence, and the rise of Napoleon.
The spread of the Napoleonic Code of Civil Law through Europe created lasting constitutional differences from America's system, which looks to statutes, the Constitution, and precedent.
Basically, the Western world is divided into those which have the common law heritage, England, America, Canada, so forth, and those that are civil law countries, namely the continent of Europe.
There are personal connections between America and the French emperor as well. In 1803, Napoleon's brother Jerome came to Philadelphia. He married an American and fathered a child, only to have the marriage declared annulled by the emperor. Jerome's grandson would become Attorney General under President Roosevelt and found what would later become the FBI. Another brother, Joseph, fled to the U.S. after Waterloo, where he lived for over 20 years, first in Philadelphia, then in Point Breeze, New Jersey. This exhibition, with its decorative arts and personal effects, is as much about Napoleon's artistic and private tastes as it is about his political prowess.
Like Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, you know, they used to love, they used to be sometimes not very nice, they used to make some mistakes.
This kind of exploration, says Linda Johnson, reflects the National Constitution Center's approach to understanding history.
One of the things we focus on quite a bit here is the personal ideology and lives of the founders. And I don't think it's any different for Napoleon. I think that in order to understand how these iconic figures rose to power and how they led, it just is very interesting to see also how they lived.
Understanding the human dimensions of those who change history helps shed light on not only the way we govern ourselves, but how we live our lives today.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The exhibition Napoleon runs through September 7th at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. The latest outing from Philadelphia's 1812 productions was created and stars longtime collaborators Jennifer Childs and Tony Braithwaite. Let's Pretend We're Married is a sometimes affectionate, sometimes satirical, sometimes wry look at marriage. Childs and Braithwaite create their own characters and also impersonate multiple iconic couples from stage, screen and popular music of the last 40 years or so. George Burns and Gracie Allen, Phyllis Diller and Fang, and Donna Meachie and Frances Langford, among many others.
What time did you get in?
I don't know.
You said you'd have one drink and get home at 10.
Well, I had 10 drinks and got home at 1.
I am just sick and tired the way your whole life is wrapped up in a bottle of bourbon. I suppose you'd like me better if I wore a label and put a cork in my mouth.
Well, you don't have to wear a label, Gwen.
The show also involves the audience in a takeoff of the Newlyweds game, with, on the night we were there, two couples married for more than 40 years taking part. Another pair from the audience performed a rather solemn renewal of their vows towards the end of the show. I spoke with Let's Pretend We're Married creators Jennifer Childs and Tony Braithwaite earlier this week. You do sail a very fine line between parodying all of these 1970s shows and people from show business and actually sort of honoring them?
I think it divides. You know, we have done Burns and Allen for a long time, and I feel like when we do them, we are very much honoring them, and we sort of pick and choose the people that we can have a go at, I guess.
Right, right. While Jen and I have both done musicals before, we wouldn't be typical cabaret artists,
that's
necessarily.
True. That's true.
So there's a little bit of camp and fun in the nature of this cabaret because it's us doing a cabaret. That's inherent in a lot of the pieces.
We're speaking after the Thursday night show, which I think is night three, is that right?
That's right.
Because you guys own this, it can clearly, the creators are in the room with you. How likely is it to change? How much do you think it's going to evolve? Has it evolved even in three performances?
A little bit. Just to give you one tiny example, Henny Youngman and Phyllis Diller seemed to really be something the audience latched on to at the first preview. So we came downstairs and said, well, maybe we'll throw in a few more jokes for them, which is easy enough from because they had such good material to cull from. But other than that, we do tweak here and tweak there, which I think is really helpful. For it keeps it fresh. It keeps us you know, committed to the piece, to each other, to the material. To you know, what if we sharpened that? What if we said that over here? Not major changes we haven't. And we were open to major changes if we needed it, but it seemed, with the first audience, they seemed to tell us that the structure was in place.
Exactly. I think that's it. It feels like the journey is, the arc of the piece is good. And so I don't foresee that we'll pull out any huge sections or change anything around.
A lot of actors will say that listening is an essential part of the craft of acting. Also an essential part, one would suspect, of good relationships. Mm-hmm. You satirize it in the piece that you can finish each other's sentences, but there does seem to be a chemistry between you.
Oh, yeah, it's the chemistry that I think inspired us to, well, for a long time to search for things to do together, but that this is a culmination of really 10 years of shorthand, of a shared love of genre, genres, whatever the plural is, of I think Jen and I see comedy and love comedy in the same kind of ways and love all aspects of creating theater in the same kind of ways. And that has created a nice bond.
I mean, a lot of times people will say, our assistant director, when she came into this process and sat with us as we were making the piece, she said, I feel like a little outside because there's so many in-jokes and you guys go so fast with each other. And it's true. After 10 years of knowing each other, we do have a shorthand and we do work fast. We were able to create this piece in relatively short amount of time because we are able to work so fast.
You do take a few risks in the piece that you're going into the audience and picking out who you hope are married couples. has that ever faltered?
Knock on wood, so far, so good. Whenever you deal with the audience, it's always... at 1812, we do a lot of audience participation in our sort of variety pieces. And, you know, you never know what you're going to get. And I think one of the joys about having Tony on stage, he works with audience in an astonishing way. He's so much faster than I am. And I think we're nice foils for each other in that way.
It's interesting because while it is always a risk... The molecules in the room change the minute the totally unexpected is put on stage. And so everybody sits up and takes notice a little bit more when that happens and creates an energy.
And you can tell when you're out in the audience, as I'm talking to people, I can sort of gauge by the look in their eyes whether there's absolute fear there, I will leave them be. And if or if they seem at all closed off and hesitant. But, you know, when people catch your gaze and make eye contact with you and are open, it's a good sign that they're going to take your hand when you say, come on up.
Jennifer Childs and Tony Braithwaite. They created and star in Let's Pretend We're Married. The latest from 1812 Productions runs through June 14th at the Independence Foundation Black Box at the Prince Music Theatre in Philadelphia. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony in C under Ross and Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.